title of this talk, or this panel, actually, is Writing Speaking. And it really is. If you don't already know me, I'm Natasha Waxman. I'm the Director of Publications, Grants, and Awards for Grindr. And I've been a professional writer for decades. So anyways, all I have to know that it really is true. You can have everything in your head and be quite sure of it all. And then when you go to write it down, you find it all falls to crap. And it's a very dispiriting experience, but I assure you it is entirely universal. And these great scientists are here to tell you all about how to mitigate this. So I'm going to go in alphabetical order and ask each of our panelists to tell us about one great paper, a paper that they consider great, not only scientifically, but in terms of how it's written. One tip that's served them well in their scientific careers as regards writing their papers, and one pitfall to avoid. And I hope those men, maybe 5-8 minutes, this is meant to be a fairly nice, loose panel session. They'll talk, they'll ask questions, we'll move on. We're going to go in alphabetical order. So it's going to be Katie Mack, Rob Myers, Rob Speckens, and Ben Webster. Okay?
Alright, so I was asked to give an example of a paper that I liked, and I chose what is really my favorite paper, and not because it's necessarily the most correct or the most groundbreaking or the most important in any way, but just because it's a really fun paper, and it's always nice to read a paper where you're reading it, you're enjoying the process of reading it. Where it's written in a way that's engaging, and with the kind of language that is very accessible, and it's a short paper, so that helps. It's easy to kind of keep it compact. It's a theory paper, but the idea behind this paper is that it's about what happens if dark energy has an equation of state less than minus one, and it came at a time when generally everybody was thinking about dark energy with an equation of state greater than minus one or equal to minus one, which is the cosmological constant. And this paper, all they did was extend the parameter space a little bit, and they found that the universe rips itself apart if you do that. And there are lots of sort of theoretical reasons why it's not very likely that you would get this scenario, but what they say is that it's reasonable to ask what the empirical results say, and so they just looked at the data and they said, if this, then this, and the universe is destroyed. And the way that they kind of presented that was to include some sort of review of the basic physics of it, the basic cosmology, to put it together in a very clear and very organized way, to walk through this argument in very clearly, and to put in some sort of implications that you could get out of that. And I just really enjoyed that way of putting together papers, saying here's an interesting question. It's not ruled out theoretically. It's not ruled out observationally. Let's just see what happens. Then you walk through. This is what happens. And here's a very clear way. You can reproduce the calculation yourself. It's very simple. And then here are the implications. And maybe it's true. Maybe it's not true. Who knows? But it's an interesting question to think about. So I just really like a paper for that reason. Again, it's a model that's probably not correct, but at least it's kind of just pointing to something really interesting. And it's compact. It's got just two figures and they're useful figures. One table that's kind of fun to read. So anyway, it's the only book that I've ever really recommended non-physicists read about cosmology, because it's so well so accessible that it's you don't have to have a degree to understand it. Okay, so that's the paper that I liked. In terms of tips, start writing as soon as you start the project, basically. That's my tip. The sooner that you can start getting references together and have a list of references, because you're going to be reading papers as you go, just keep a list of references, start writing bits of the methods of the paper, the process you're going through as you're going. You'll revise everything in the end anyway, but you don't need to wait till every piece of the project is done before writing up, because it's a lot easier to kind of keep track of where you are on the project, and then you can use the draft of the paper in some ways as a bit of a record of what you're doing, and then you'll condense it, you'll change it as you when you finish up, but at least having something put together is very helpful as you're going through a project. And it also, as Natasha was saying, like, it helps you kind of think about what you're doing as you're doing the project. It helps you think about what are the interesting questions here, what can I really learn from this? And then TIFL, so I put kind of obscuring the main takeaway of the paper would be a TIFL. So what I mean by that is the vast majority of people, if they look at your paper at all, they're going to read the abstract, the conclusion, and they're going to look at the figures. And that's it. Most people are not going to get farther than that. So you want it to be really clear in those sections exactly what the point of your paper is. If you have a big result, like put the numbers in the abstract, put the point of it in the abstract, put the main reason you wrote the paper into the abstract, the conclusions, and make sure that at least one of the figures has, you know, whatever your result is, if it's something that you come across in a figure, because that's how that information is going to get across. Most people are not going to kind of read through it. And even if it's something where, you know, you have lots of caveats or something, you can say, you know, with some caveats or whatever. But you want it to be clear that there is a reason you wrote the paper, there is a takeaway from your research, and this is what it is.
Actually, maybe can I have one comment on producing what you're saying about starting early?
Yeah.
I would say that often, or maybe early on, I thought that, you know, once the research is over, you start writing the paper. But actually, the discipline of trying to write something out often causes you to go back to the research and say, oh, I thought I'd proven this, but actually, no.
Yeah.
And similarly, talking about something shouldn't happen after the paper's over. So I find that giving a talk about something is very different from writing a paper, but the necessity of kind of summarizing the main points in a talk often improves your paper. Because now it's like, I know now what the point of my paper was, and I'm going to go back and write it more carefully.
Yeah, and with talks also, you get comments and questions that can really, really clarify.
Yep.
Quick question. So would you say that when you start this draft of ideas, because I also like it, would you say, like, write everything to the detail or be more like concise and descriptive and then come and fill in the details? Like, what's your message?
So I would say put in as much detail as you can as your beginning. Some of that will be cut out for the final paper. Some might go to an appendix. In any case, like if you went through some multi-step process to calculate something, you can decide later how much of that is really necessary for getting a point across.
Because in the final paper, you really want it to be written so that somebody could follow, you know, could reproduce your results. So in some cases, you'll need a lot of steps for that. In some cases, you know, it'll be a standard procedure and you won't. And you don't necessarily know ahead of time which way that's going to be when you're first starting in a field. But yeah, I would definitely err on the side of getting as much documented as possible as you go. And then, you know, you'll compress it, you'll condense it, you'll take things in and out as you're doing the final write-up. But it doesn't hurt to have that documented stuff like in an organized fashion.
Katie, you talked about the pleasure of writing, of reading, and the authors had walked the reader through the argument so clearly that you felt like even a non-physicist could read it.
Yeah.
I think this is likely something that takes a lot of skill to do. And my guess is that the younger the researcher, the more they may struggle with, well, what's the right level where I don't feel, it doesn't feel like I'm talking down to anyone, it doesn't feel, and also I'm not assuming too much.
Mm-hmm.
What's a good way of finding that level?
I think that's difficult. I think there's part of that is just experience, but you kind of want to assume, I guess, that the final reader is going to be very much like you were when you started the project. So you know they're not going to have the experience that you built up as you did the project, but they're clearly interested in the topic enough to read your paper. They're going to read beyond the abstract and the conclusion. If they're reading all of your text, and that means that they might want to get into that field, they might have some interest in that field there. So they probably have a background pretty similar to what you had before you started writing the paper. So I would, you know, especially if it's kind of a project you're just starting out and not an extension on a previous one. So so that would be kind of my rule of thumb, but yeah, it's something that you'll get to know as you go.
I think that's great advice. Rob, I think you're next in the alphabet, and next on the, you can advance the slides. Oh, here, so I'll do it.
There
you go.
Hey. So, as is usual, it's gone about an hour of my attention this morning. And so, rather than answering the questions, I wrote a short haiku. and it really seemed to make sense this morning, but let me see, what does this mean? So I'm going to jump into the ABC, and it may seem like I'm in the wrong place to be saying this about science papers, but what do I mean by that? So be humble. What does that mean? It really means that writing a paper is not an opportunity for you to show everybody how smart you are. And it connects to the second one, which is show gratitude, which is really the theme that, you know, when I go to a paper, I am, you know, drawn by, I have a lot of things, there's a lot of things going on, and I'm devoting my attention to your paper. And so I'm doing that because I'm hoping to learn something from you. And so really go in with that attitude that, you know, your reader has a million papers they could you probably write them, but, and you really want to help them through the arguments. And you really want to teach them. And, you know, Katie was talking about the target audience. You know, my target audience is always people in this room. I mean, you know, Katie was saying that they're only going to read the abstract, the discussion, and maybe look at the figures. But the person who's going to read all the way through the paper is going to be that poor grad student who was assigned by his advisor to read this paper and figure out what it means. And so I'm sincere when I think that, you know, that's who I think my reader is, and I want to help them work their way through this. You know, tied with A and B, I mean, another idea that was already presented is, you know, you've been in this project probably for months now. You know, you understand everything. You know, you're intimate with the first, you know, 20 references at the back of the paper, but your reader is not. And so you really want to, you know, help them through. And I don't know, I think Katie had it right. It's experience that teaches you how to do it. But, you know, although the one thing I disagree with is people don't mind being talked down to. That makes them feel smart. But you know, to help them through, you don't want to regurgitate or repeat everything that they can find in another paper, but you want to give them the salient points so that you know what your starting point is, and then work through the argument. And that brings me to number C, which was tell a story. And that's my picture here. You know, when I do research, it's an exploration. And you wander around. Sometimes you get lost. Sometimes you have a brilliant idea. And eventually you get somewhere. But writing the paper is not an excuse to regurgitate all of your notes into a tech file. I really encourage you, you know, to step back and think about what the story is. You know, what's the cleanest way to take you from your starting point to your end point? And that may mean that, you know, many of your calculations, well, maybe they go to appendices, but maybe they don't even make it into the paper. It may mean that you're going to change your notation. You know, that all those notes, all those equations, you're going to rewrite them because there's a cleaner way to tell the story. But I think that's that was my third important one. that you really, you know, again, it's all, they're all combined together, and it's really, you don't have to follow this set of advice, but it's really my philosophy when I'm writing. I'm there to try and help the next grad student, you know, work through this problem and thoroughly teach them something, and I hope they do. So I had the audacity when I was asked for, it was called a great paper on the slide that I was given, but I think it's a pretty well-written paper. I had the audacity to choose one of my own, and I did that because I spent an hour flipping through all these great papers, and it was really exciting, but usually what excites me is the new physics that they discovered or something like that. This one comes with an anecdote, which is, this is really, an incremental advance. It's following up on a paper by two famous people, Mike Douglas and Greg Moore. And the anecdote is, well, this is back in the day when we printed our papers, and they came out in the common printer, and then they got stacked, and you went, after half an hour or whatever, and picked up your paper. But a friend of mine at MIT had printed out this famous paper by Douglas and Moore, and he went to find it at the printer, and someone had carefully stacked it, and they wrote a note. They said, if you really want to understand what's going on here, you should read this paper. And so it's just an example that, that clarity, that effort to teach people, I think, that I've always, I've tried, at least for most of my career. I know it annoys many of my collaborators and students, including Brian and Doctor. That pays off. People enjoy reading those papers. They do learn something, and I think you're really contributing to the field best in that way. So I'll pause there, and if there are any questions.
I guess I have a question about, sure. you told about the journey, you get lost, you make mistakes and things like that. Sometimes I think, isn't there some value in also telling the others, yeah, you can try to do this, but it won't work. So that people don't waste their time doing things that you've already worked out for your notes or in your experience, like maybe it's the most natural way to go, but at the end it doesn't work. Is it worth telling people that in a paper, even though it takes you away from this main path?
It can be, but as you said that, to me, it sounds like a discussion session.
I guess.
That
okay.
It's an anecdote or it's something answer. I'm not going to develop a section of my paper.
Okay. No, that's fair.
So I haven't read this paper, but I'm sorry. was it saying that the previous paper was correct, or were you criticizing something about the previous paper? Or was it putting in some kind of
context? No, it was just, it was expanding on what they had done. They had done, something very technical and very specific, and we were expanding it to a larger context. But we took the time to sort of, I was looking at the paper, here's the motivation, two or three sections of, various background materials. Okay, now this is how we go. It just took the time to explain what was going on in a way that you don't see.
So if you were writing a paper where you did have to say that a previous work was wrong or incomplete, or because this is something that comes up, right? Like when you follow up on something else, sometimes you find problems with the previous thing. What's your advice on how to deal with that? Like how to present?
What are we talking about? This equation is wrong in that paper.
Well, the assumptions here are unreasonable, or the application doesn't make sense, or we have this, there's a better model for this starting point, and therefore we followed it. Like, is there some etiquette that you can suggest for doing that?
I guess I would be gracious. However, I see that in that the next paper I'm writing with Ivan has a section in the discussion section that says shortcomings from previous analysis. And the previous analysis is mine. I wouldn't get carried away with it. I mean, it's you know, these people laid the foundations for what I'm doing. And, perhaps there were typos in their paper, that's often the case. You know, maybe that's worth a footnote. I wouldn't dwell on it. I'd dwell on carrying it forward.
I'll just pick up on something. You used the word motivation, and you know that explaining the motivation for the paper in the first place is important. Do you want to say anything more about that? Is that always evident? Is that a common flaw?
I don't see it as a flaw. I that's why you have introductions in your paper, right? You want to try and set the context. Again, you know, I'm assuming this person or my reader is you know, not as intimately familiar and not as excited, you know, by this work that I've been working on passionately for 3 months. And so, yeah, you want to provide the context and the, you know, where does this fit in the bigger picture?
Yeah.
What was driving you? Why did you ask this question?
Yeah.
But I don't.
So where I was going personally was just that of course you as an author do think this question is fascinating, but you can't take that as a given.
Yeah. Okay.
And so that sort of reminding yourself and somehow putting that the force that's really the engine that's going to drive a lot of the is the energy of the importance of the fascination of the initial question, the motivation. That's where I was going.
Okay. Couldn't have said it.
Okay.
That's right. Oh, okay.
Okay, so the paper I chose, those papers, this one by Kate Merman called Invariables and the Two Theories of John Bell. And I chose it for two reasons. One, as we've heard already, you know, great papers really provide great explanations. And David Merman is one of the great explainers. I think it comes from maybe spending a lot of time teaching undergraduates, but his writing is extremely clear. He explains things better than almost anyone else. And this is an amazing example of that if you look at this paper. Everything's extremely well explained. But Merman's also a really great writer. I mean, it's just a joy to read his paper. So I took a couple things out. This is the beginning of the text of the paper. I'll just read a little bit. It's a fundamental quantum doctrine that a measurement does not, in general, reveal a pre-existing value of the measured property, blah, blah, blah. We have been told this so often that the eyes glaze over at the words, and half of you probably stopped reading already. But is it really true? And it's just a great way to start a paper, because it's engaging, and it's fun. And throughout the paper, it's just a lot of fun to read. The paper ends with, you know, this wonderful line, to those for whom non-locality is anathema, Bell's theorem finally spells the death of the hidden variables program. The point here is that, you know, when you're writing a paper, you want to do the job as well as you can. You know, you're not writing literature, but you have a chance to write really well. And, you know, you can always hone that skill. And the better your paper is, you know, just in terms of quality of writing, the more people will be inclined to keep reading it. So if I think about my best papers, the ones that I really spent a lot of time trying to make them kind of fun to read and well-written, when I pick them up years later and start reading, I find I can't stop. I'm like, oh, that was a good line. You know, I'll just keep reading. And you know, it's just fun. And my impression is that those are the papers that often have sort of real legs. They kind of stand the test of time. And you know, a paper that's a fantastic, amazing result will be read regardless of how badly it's written, typically. But those are few and far between. And if you can write a paper really well, then, you know, you're going to increase your readership and have more engagement. Okay, so on to tips. So my tip is, as you're writing the paper, think of yourself as a playwright. So this is a bit close to what we heard about, you know, being a storyteller. So my wife writes plays, and she also is a dramaturg, which means like an editor of playwrights. And a lot of what she says about, you know, what playwrights should keep in mind as they're writing, I find very similar, very analogous to things I might tell my students about what they should keep in mind when they're writing a paper. So one thing that's important is like having a through line. So it's something that's sort of common throughout the paper, and the image they use in playwriting sometimes is this is like a rope in a snowstorm. So you know you got to sort of follow along, and so if you're writing, and in a physics paper, you know, it can be a snowstorm at some point where it's like, oh, there's a lot of stuff coming at you, and I need the reader to get through this. But as long as they sort of know why they're doing it and being led along, because there's sort of a thesis, and you're reminding the reader, you know, this is why we're going through this. That's really important. The reader should always sort of know why they're in it and where they're going. There's also the idea of sort of story threads. Like often, you know, a good story has multiple threads. There might be like a big thread and then a few minor threads, and they kind of weave together. Well, it's the same in a physics paper. You know, you're going to have your main thread, but there's often going to be things that are kind of interesting asides, and it's not just at one point, but maybe throughout the paper. And you kind of have to weave those together and sort of have a sense of balance. I guess what I'm saying is, like, all these things I'm going to tell you, you know, you should keep them in mind when you're writing the paper. And when you step back and you look at the paper, sort of look at it through this lens. So, like, in my field, I might write a paper where, you know, most of what I'm saying is about a case where for classical stuff. But I might have some interesting results that are about the quantum generalization. So that might be a theme that sort of crops up throughout. That, okay, but this is not a paper about the quantum generalization. But there's some interesting connections here, and I'm going to tell you that whenever it's sort of appropriate to tell you that. And there might even be some stuff about, you know, post-quantum generalizations for more general theories. And that's another theme that goes through the paper. And so in playwriting, people say, like, you should be able to take, you know, one of those threads or sort of a certain character and maybe, like, read it through just about them, and it still kind of makes sense. And so it's the same if you've got a thread that goes about the paper, somebody should be able to go find those bits, and it should make sense. It should tell a story about that topic alone. I find it really useful to think about ideas, concepts that are introduced in your paper as kind of like characters. So often, you know, I'll be reading a draft of something, and I'll notice, hey, there's this concept which just plays a huge role. Where does it get introduced? It gets introduced, you know, in the middle of the proof of this thing. And, you know, that just doesn't make sense, right? Because now you have to send people back, like, oh, you remember in that proof we introduced them? Well, actually, that's important. No, they should be introduced as a character, you know, headlined somewhere in a preliminary section or something, but it should be clear, like, this is important. There might be bit characters, things that you can sort of introduce along the way as you're proving something, but the stuff that's really important, you should sort of recognize it and make it clear to the reader that, you know, that these concepts, these definitions, these are sort of critical for you know, what's going to come next. Other tricks is that, you know, it's humans reading your paper, it's not like writing a computer program. So you might write something that's unambiguous and fine, but just hard to penetrate. So this happens a lot when, you know, you decide to refer to figure 2B, you know, seven times because it's depicted in figure 2B, or, you know, some proposition 3.1, and the reader's like, what was proposition 3.1? I don't remember. It kind of makes it hard to read. So what I find a useful trick is to actually try to give names to things that are important. So if you have a theorem or a lemma that you can refer to, you know, give it a name. So that thereafter, you might be able to give the number, but you can also kind of give it a name, and then people are like, oh, I know what you're talking about, because you've referred to it many times by name. Or, you know, if there are some figures that are important, give them names. So, like, in my work, we have these directed acyclic graphs, and sometimes there's, like, long sections of the paper that are about a specific directed acyclic graph. So what we find really useful is, like, you know, you've got a graph, and you figure out, what does that look like? Okay, that's going to be called the triangle scenario. It kind of looks like a triangle. Or, you know, I think in our last winter school, we had like the hockey player, we had like all these sort of funny names for these graphs. And it made it like, you'll know that you have to do this in your paper when with your collaborators, you find that you can't talk about it without these kind of short, you know, form names for things, because it just becomes too hard to construct sentences. So as soon as you find yourself kind of inventing names for things, that means that in the paper you have to do that as well. And it usually increases the readability a lot. So I think I'll just get to my pitfall then, which is, and so this is, I think, a hard won lesson for me that, you know, in the early days of writing papers, I think I was always tempted to present my result in its most general form, right? So in the research, I started with some little result and I generalized it and then I realized, oh, actually, this is part of a bigger result. And then I had this like glorious final thing, which was not simpler, typically more complicated, harder to understand. And I'd say, yeah, I'll start with that and then I'll show people the special cases. And what you find is that you give this to your colleagues who you maybe even explained your idea to, and they say, this is impenetrable. Why didn't you start with the simple cases that you told me about, which I understood? And so what I found over and over again is that the right progression is always from concrete to abstract, right? And so that you, it's a pitfall to think it's the opposite. And it kind of makes sense if, you know, if you're going to try to explain, you know, to a child, you know, what a cat is, you don't kind of list all the properties. You just show them a lot of examples, and eventually they pick up what the idea is. And it's the same in a physics paper. I think the best way is to present a number of examples, kind of build up to, it's like in a story, you know, you have your sort of story beats, which then build up to a climax, and now the reader's prepared, right? And so it's the same. You introduce something with examples, get them in the right frame of mind, and then when you have your big result, you know, in its full generality, they're in a position to appreciate it, and there's a feeling of inevitability. Oh, you've set me up, so I know that it's got to be like this. And yeah, I think that's all my comments.
I think it's interesting the way you're phrasing it, because it just conflicts with the idea that we, I think, learned at school that like more scientific writing should be more, I don't know, like straightforward, just say your result or state your result, like as possible. Do not build like suspense, or because it feels like it's more like a story. I don't know. They tend to separate literature from like scientific writing as sort of opposite ways, and you're trying to conciliate them somehow. I don't know. Like, is it fine to like kind of build this suspense or in your paper?
That's a good question. Yeah, building suspense might not be something that necessarily want to do in a physics paper. I guess most of what I was saying is just, it's hard enough to kind of communicate difficult concepts. So certainly I think building up with simple examples towards more general result, it's just, that's the way we learn, and so it's sort of useful for communicating it. I think I disagree with the idea, except certainly you want to kind of be humble and not say, oh, this is the greatest thing ever, you know, you just sort of want to say it like it is. And so, in that sense, you kind of want to leave yourself out of it and write in a kind of scientific style. But I think, you know, that there's maybe a tendency to think that a scientific style is kind of devoid of fun and interest and like, you know, why should you be excited by this? You know, I think that's false. It should communicate the kind of excitement. And like a paper that starts, let M be a manifold, is just not as much fun to read as, you know, a paper that starts the way a firm paper starts. So that's my view.
I mean, if I understand you correctly, I mean, I think there is a genuine tension here of you both want to say your result as quickly as possible. So, you know, if somebody's scanning the abstract, they see what is this paper about.
Right.
But there is also, like, some real value in being, hey, let's go through this particular example first, so you see concretely how this works. Ah, now you understand what the result is.
Right.
And those things are not contradictions, but they are a little bit intentional. Right. But it's sort of, you're not, right, I think when Rob says, like, don't start with the general result, he doesn't mean, like, hide the general result. Don't put it in the abstract. Don't put it in the introduction. You know, only show it to people who go through the examples. But I think he means, okay, you know, tell people what the result is, and, you know, maybe you can't put in all the details, right? But tell them what kind of result it is, and do the best you can to state it in a way that someone who really knows what's going on can pick it up in a few sentences. But then for people who can't pick it up in a few sentences, you should have some examples that they'll be able to understand. And then after going through those, they'll be prepared to understand the general result.
Yes, very good. Science. And I can say one more thing in support of that. That often, you know, you want to say it in the abstract, where you use kind of a very general way. And then in the introduction, sometimes at the end, you might also want to say what the big result is. But you, again, don't have the kind of full apparatus to say it properly, because you haven't even defined things. And so finally, in the paper, you'll get a chance to really say it right, because everything will be flipped up. So it's kind of like multiple passes. You might be able to tell your big message many times, but you know, the last time you tell it is the time that will be in kind of its full glory, with everything defined precisely.
Because this idea of a snowflake model of writing, which is, you know, like, so that if you should write the abstract in the best way for someone who will read the abstract and look at no other part of it. And you should write the introduction in the best way for someone who only read the introduction and ignore the rest of the paper. It's sort of the idea, but you know, the first N pages should be like, if someone were going to read the N page version of the paper, that's what you're going to write. And you know, again, there's some tension because you don't literally want to do that with like the first page and second page and third page. But you know, you should think about like, people aren't going to read the whole paper, so you should write the whole paper in a way that is valuable if someone reads every word of it, but also valuable if someone reads the first two paragraphs, also valuable if someone reads the introduction.
Katie, I think you had a point?
Yeah, I just wanted to kind of elaborate a little bit on some of the things that are coming up here. So I think a lot of times when we write a paper, we're thinking of it as, I just did a whole bunch of work, and writing a paper is how I show I did a bunch of work, and how I prove that like I am useful and like important in my field, right? But there is a sense in which like you do have to write a paper because that's part of your productivity and your advancement and all of that. But the point of the paper, the reason that we write papers is so that they are useful. And so they are useful to the field, they are useful to people who read them, they advance, they allow other people to make other advances on top of what you have done. Right, and so there are lots of different ways for paper to be useful. One is to have a big new result that changes our perspective on the science in some way. Another way is to recontextualize something that's already been done in a way that makes it clearer and more accessible and more applicable and more general. And so sometimes a paper might not have that much in the way of original stuff, but it's something that is useful because it makes it clear what's already been done. And another way that a paper can be useful is if it's something that's you know, maybe a small part of a bigger question, but like just laid out in such a way so now you know how to use that piece, right? Now you know how to put that into something. And so good writing is really important for a lot of that. If your paper is not easy to follow, if it's not well organized, it's not going to be useful because nobody's going to be able to get that useful piece out of it. They're not going to be able to build on it. They're not going to read through the whole thing to find out what is useful in it. And so, like, the main thing you should be thinking about when you write your paper is how will people use this most effectively? What is the purpose of this paper? How will people find it useful? And then, you know, the nice advantage of that is if it's useful, people will cite it. And then, you know, that's also a very helpful thing for your career. So telling a good story, having it be really clear and easy to follow, having it be engaging, and also, you know, there are other ways to make something useful, but you know, don't neglect that writing part, because it's not going to be useful if nobody's reading it, and nobody's going to be reading it if it's not interesting and you know, something that you want to read, because we all have limited attention spans and we have other things to do. But if your paper is really well written and really like nicely laid out, people are going to be, oh, I read this really useful paper and it helped me understand something, and now I understand this field better. Here, check this out. And that's how people kind of pass that information around.
And I'll just sort of follow up on that by saying, you know, writing is largely editing. And this can be a little less clear at the outset, you know, especially when you read really well-written things. They're perfect. They're inevitable. They are exactly, you know, they're clear and it's all obvious, and it mustn't have taken very long to get that way. You know, it was all just written down so nicely. That typically is the result of good editing. And usually editing is not one pass, it's many passes. I think very likely what do we think, your people?
Peter, you've got, you know, the name of your file.
Yeah.
You know, version 47.
Yeah. Final.
Yes.
Most excellently final. Really, this is the end final. So you know, to the extent that it's humanly possible, don't ever undervalue your terrible, terrible drafts. They are so important. And with that, let's go. There we go.
Okay, so I mean, somehow looking at other people's examples, there's maybe a good one picked a funnier paper. But I think this is actually a really beautiful one by Michael Mattia. And it's called Topological Quantum Field Theory. And one of the things I like about it is it's basically like the bat signal, right? So Tia had sort of talked to physicists and read metaphysics papers. And he's like, hey, mathematicians, there's a thing. It's called quantum field theory. You should think about it. And that's basically all the paper does. It's sort of, there's, you know, maybe a page and a half of discussion about like what's been happening, about the interaction between especially sort of differential geometry and physics. There's sort of a few pages of, hey, this is what a topological quantum field theory is. Here's how I can like explain it to you in a way that a mathematician will understand. And then there's like two pages of examples. Here are things that actually are there in the literature. Here's how you think about this topological quantum field theories. And basically, I think almost no other mathematicians had any idea what a topological quantum field theory was when those papers were written. I expect very few physicists in the late 70s. So it's been sort of developed a huge industry out of that, in part it's because it had such a wealth in certain. Since I'm going last, I get to kind of build off of everyone else's. I have to admit, when I first got the email asking me to be on this panel, I sort of thought, oh geez. Because actually writing is a huge struggle for me. It's really hard, and I'm still, it's sort of the part of my kind of scientific career I'm least satisfied with. It's what I've been able to write for years. And a lot of that has to do with editing, right? That I think I maybe take this this plan of starting early a little too seriously, or you know, somehow I actually don't like that I do it, but I found no other way to think things through than just start writing the paper. And unfortunately, this results in my getting halfway through and then saying, oh, maybe I need a different notation. Oh, no, actually, this term should have meant something else. Oh, no, actually, this result is different. What I originally thought was the result was wrong. And so maybe I will push back a tiny bit on that, and that, like, it can be to your benefit to not have, like, a draft where you decide it halfway through that you need a different notation. You might want to figure some of those things out. Or you might want to start over. This is again, you know, there's sort of all these great things that people tell me to do, and I'm like, that's such a good idea. I can't force myself to do it. One of which is like, print off the paper and start over, like looking at the old paper, but not saving the file. So save the file and you save the titles. So this is sort of one instance of my tip. So indeed, editing is really important, and you really need to get distance when you edit. And there are a lot of different ways of doing this, but it's so easy to look at something you wrote and think that you know what is written on the paper because it's there in your head, but that's not what's on the paper. But you can't see it. I've learned this very painfully over the past couple of decades. So there are all kinds of things you can do to get yourself sort of distance. So you can print out the paper. You could, if you're going to start a draft early, you could start writing the draft in longhand, and then you can type it out. I know people who swear by reading aloud. I don't think I have the guts to do that, but there are also people where now you can get AI to read your paper to you. And if there's anything that's going to make you like find stuff that sounds awful, it's going to be the AI reading it to you. And one I've actually really been liking is reading your paper backwards. So you start at the end of the paper, you read the last paragraph, and then you go from back to front. And this can actually help, for example, with these characters. You meet a character at the end of the story, and you say, well, shoot, how do I start that story? And then you discover it was introduced somewhere in the middle of some paragraph where no one's going to notice it. And then you go back and fix it. So I just think, you know, I really like strongly believe that as dumb as some of them sound, like having these kind of gimmicks to get you to just look at your paper differently and actually look at what is on the page and not what you believe is there, is really valuable. And maybe it's sort of my tip and my pitfall are kind of combined together. Because I know for me, a huge pitfall is I think I know what's on the page, and it makes no sense to anyone else. And luckily, I often have co-authors who are like, what the hell are you talking about? And I say, actually, that doesn't make sense. I've gotten a little better now about like a comeback a few days later before I send it to my co-authors and do a read through myself. Because, you know, like my first day's draft is, I think, totally even though the other people were pretty much into it. But there's no shame in that, and the only solution is to go back and edit, as unpleasant as it is.
One comment that we said, I mean, one of the great things about having co-authors, it's like having a reader. You know, mm-hmm. Like if you're the one doing most of the writing, then your co-authors will tell you, this paragraph made no sense, I don't even know what you're trying to say here, and then you have to sort of see it anew. And your co-authors already know everything that's in there, so if they can't understand it, then you know your readers won't understand it. So yeah, like your co-authors often are a great way to provide that sort of new set of eyes on what you've written.
Oh, and one thing I meant to mention, you know, this idea of giving talks or explaining something to another person, giving you fresh perspective, that's another way of getting distance, right? That's putting your ideas into another medium where you think differently about how you have to structure them. And then it's extremely frequent, at least I give a talk about something, I'm like, okay, that's actually a certain big idea, that's good. You know, I very recently had some idea, and it's kind of a little bit half-formed, and I mentioned it at the end of the talk that I gave at a conference a couple of weeks ago. And the audience started talking to me, I started talking to one of the grad students about it, and it really sort of, I realized, that was actually what I meant. You know, the thing I put in the talk was kind of half-formed and didn't necessarily make that much sense, and just talking to people the last couple of weeks, it's sort of sharpened.
Sorry, another thought. Just right. That something that you kind of don't realize at first is that often you can have finished the paper, given talks on it, and still not really know what the paper was about. and so it reminds me of stories in playwriting, actually. So Hannah Moscovich is a famous Canadian playwright. I heard her on CBC Radio once talking about one of her most famous plays. And she was talking about how they were like about to put on the play for the first time, and she was talking to like the actors who were playing her characters. And in the conversation with the actor who played her main character, she suddenly realized what her play was about. And she had to do some rewriting. And basically, the main character's father was a terrible person, and the play was about how he still loved his father, in spite of that. And I thought, yeah, that really resonated. Like, often, you know, you get to the end, and you're like, actually, only now do I really know what this was all about. And then you go back, and you rewrite.
Well, I mean, it's very normal that you end up, you know, something was so long ago, it's so messed up, you just have to write another paper, right? You know, I think if you talk to people who've written papers, you know, decades ago, they'll probably tell you, shoot, done it this way, like, I see now. I mean, actually, one of the things you're pointing about characters made me think of is, you know, the person who's most likely to be citing your papers in the future is you. And so you should also write in a way that makes it easy for you in the future to cite what is happening in your paper, right? Like if you introduce a character buried somewhere in a footnote, you're gonna, you know, feel like an idiot writing your paper 5 years in the future and being like, well, in a footnote to this on page such and such we introduce, when you could have sort of brought it in a way that's easier to cite it as well as easier for the person.
Question for the rest of the panel. When you're writing up something and it's there are sort of lots of moving parts to whatever you're doing, how do you decide where to put a boundary? This is the end of this paper, the next bit is for paper two. what is, you know, people sometimes talk about the sort of minimum publishable quality, like, you know, trying to get out as many, trying to get out as many small papers as possible just to make it look like they're publishing a lot versus, like, some people will spend, you know, a year writing a 30-page tome with lots of ideas in it. Like, what's the, you know, what's your perspective on how to make those calls and how to chop up research? Because there's no like, we started, we finished, we're done with science. But there's always more to do. There's always more pieces, things to refine. How do you approach that?
I think probably varies a lot by field. Right, the idea that 30 pages is like, whoa.
I was going to say, for me, 100 over 100. My co-authors are we going to break 100?
there is a certain amount of, like, it's important to get the judgment of people who know your field and know kind of what the expectations are there. Like, what are the expectations of journals going to be? This is actually, like, If you write something that's in a format that's not what the journal is expecting, that's not good. It's not a good way to get your paper published. Other than that, vibes. what just feels like a good cohesive unit, right? So I think the ideal thing is to have one really great idea. You're explaining the paper, and then kind of it feels like, okay, well, if I cut out any part of this, it would kind of weaken the idea, and if I add in anything more, it would dilute things, but, it's a tough decision. I've had plenty of times where I started writing one thing, and I was like, oh, no, this is two papers, no, this is three papers.
But for me, it kind of happens organically. Now, as you're writing, you kind of get the sense of, like, what is the main narrative theme of this paper? And it sort of evolved into, okay, now it's solidified. Then at some point, some people say, well, what about this point? And you realize that doesn't quite fit with our main theme. Maybe it's time to bifurcate, and, this can go in another paper. Or else you might say, well, actually, now that you think about it, like, this is so important, really the theme should change. And so we can incorporate this, but really we do need to do some rewriting because the theme is now this different theme. So sort of, I usually find there's sort of a moment where you have to make the decision. Are we changing the narrative to put all this stuff in, or are we bifurcating? And it sort of just happens organically, and you fight among your co-authors, and then it's often nice to sort of get something out of a paper, because otherwise it's mission creep, right? Your paper's trying to do this one thing, but then you've just got all this stuff that kind of drags you down. It's all this extra things that the reader has to read. You get it out, and it's like, oh, that could be a great future paper that's self-contained. But sometimes it's just, well, actually, that wasn't quite as significant, and we never came back to it, and that's okay. But there's so many things you want to write. Now it's just on a shelf somewhere.
Yeah, the question was, how do you decide when to split the paper? In my case, it's poorly. but I think, I'm aligned with what Rob was saying. It's you're trying to tell a story, somehow it's organic that you understand this is my story. But I do know that I ended up more than one case where, there's this attendance. You could have written a really great paper, but that's just it.
Well, sometimes getting it in the appendix is a way that it's out there, and I didn't have to write a whole paper on it, because
I don't expect to have the time to write a whole paper.
That happens a lot. But then it deserves to be in the appendix, so it doesn't take away from the main thread.
Yeah, I think my... I kind of vibes is sort of how I think about it as well, I think that for me, like, it's a hard balance between putting out something that's contained and useful in itself versus just never finishing the paper because there's always something you can refine and make a little better, and like this other piece might be important, maybe we should explore that for our space. And then the paper is never done, and then it's not useful anyway. So that balance is something that's always, every time it's a little bit hard to figure out where that is.
I have a question for anyone on the panel about non-results, because I think sometimes you do a whole project that just ends up being either not significant or a small difference or something, so maybe you decide not publishable, but I guess you could also argue that, you know, it educates people that this is all is kind of less of the candor, don't spend your time doing the same thing I've already done. But I guess if you did write a paper on that, you also don't have a lot of the things we've been discussing about like exciting motivation or highlighting your big results, because it's just kind of null.
I mean, I think for me, I go back to that question of, is it useful? So if it's something that at first glance looks like it might be an interesting thing, then writing a paper saying, actually, that's a 10^-24 effect and we'll never discover it, that might be useful to people. Whereas if it's just, you kind of went down an alleyway and didn't get anywhere, then that's not necessarily useful. So I would, for me, it's that question of like, is somebody going to get something out of reading this? And knowing that certain something is not important is often useful, right? So it's, I don't know, it's hard to say always, but please.
That's a really tough question. There are cases where it's something you put in a discussion session or an appendix. But I do know that, I think I tend not to. Like, if I try something and just fail, I wouldn't write up that. I think in general our field doesn't, but I think it there is a loss there. I don't know how to fix it, but where there is this sort of idea in the air, and you try, and it doesn't work, and you don't tell anybody about it, and I don't know how many other people try the same thing. Also, it could also be something. I don't know. Maybe a talk is more appropriate, or something like that. But my sense is generally, at least in my field, we tend to.
Guys, we have one question from the online viewers.
Yes,
or participants.
Sort of along the same theme. Someone in the virtual audience has a question of, at what point do you decide you have enough for a paper?
So what is that minimum?
Yes.
Yeah.
Again, it depends a lot on your field. There are like 2 or 3 page papers out there, right? So there's sometimes, if you just make an interesting observation, like that. Something which might be relevant, which I think is also relevant to your questions, you also shouldn't let this idea of like, oh, we want to write really great papers stop you from writing papers at all, right? Like, the sad fact is you guys are grad students. You do need to finish papers, and probably most of them are not going to set the world on fire. But the thing that's sad is that, it might actually be a very bad trade-off, right? It's easy for us up here to be like, well, there are 3 other papers I want to write. I'm not going to spend time writing on this one that's just kind of like, this thing doesn't work. But, when you're a grad student, you have less time to kind of go down blind alleys and just be like, well, I guess I'll do something else.
That said, I guess it depends on your resources. Because almost any, a small result can make a very nice short paper that's valuable to people. You can write it up, but it's just a small thing, and you don't write it on the night for you. But often, as a researcher, you have a small result, and you say, well, this is goal, right? This is an idea that I can work on, I can generalize this, I want to spend some time getting something better. And that can go on indefinitely. You can make a paper sort of as big as you like, just like keeping going on it. So it's usually a question of like, at any given time you could stop and make a paper out of it. And it kind of depends on factors like, oh, your student needs to apply, so we're going to stop it here, or there's a deadline coming up, and so we're going to stop it here. Like, and those are the kinds of factors that, in my experience, sort of tell you when you need to stop. It's never entirely dictated by what the sort of science says the natural stopping point.
Yeah, I think what you're saying is experience, and in particular as a grad student, you may well be writing with senior people. You're going to rely on them. I'm going to turn it around. That sad story that you were telling,
know, if I didn't have grad students, I don't think I would have written a paper in the last 5 years. It's really riffing on what you said. You know, I think that's a big motivation.
Yeah.
And the paper, the realization that, you know, there are young people here in their careers.
And there are different philosophies, except some people abide by the philosophy of, you know, one idea, one paper, it should be short, something should be able to read quickly, get the main idea. Other people like to write papers that are very exhaustive, like, oh, you know, this is going to go through the whole topic, and it's going to be quite long, but it's going to be kind of comprehensive. And there's merit to both. It kind of depends on you to some extent, which is the right thing to choose. I find a mix is good. You know, every once in a while you have a cute little result that fits into four pages and you say, well, we submit this to PRL, you know? It depends on the project, but I would say if you're either extreme all the time, probably you need to diversify.
What you just mentioned, the PRL, that's actually a really interesting way to crystallize your ideas. taking on the challenge and explaining yourself. And yet,
I think your hand went up first. Yes.
Going back to this idea of telling a story, which is, of course, a great strategy of communication, I guess it's also the danger of, you know, being too biased with your story, and being too enamored with your story from the beginning. And so, you know, maybe you don't explain all the caveats in the proper way. So how do you handle that? Do you finish the research and then you try to make the story that you want to, you know, to tell, or you know, how do you handle that? Because maybe you had an idea in the beginning and, you know, through your research there are a lot of caveats, but you still want to, you know, push this idea forward. And then you write your paper, you know, in a biased way, which maybe doesn't reflect, you know, the complications. I don't know if this, maybe this is not a problem with, you know, within physics, but in other fields like, you know, psychology or, you know, biology, where things are hard to reproduce, it's an issue. So I don't know if you have.
So I guess I'll come down, maybe people disagree, but I'll come down on, it's actually, I find, you know, the papers that are the most valuable is when the author has an axe to grind. And because then it's sort of clear what they're trying to persuade you of, and you can evaluate their arguments, like, am I persuaded or am I not? And you might come away saying, well, no, I'm not persuaded, and I actually, the opposite point of view. But those papers really sort of force you to say, you know, do I believe it, and you know, how strong are the arguments? And it's much easier to get engaged with that kind of paper than somebody who just tries to say, you know, not stick their neck out and say, well, you know, these are the facts, or, like, it's often the case that having an axe to grind is really good, even if in the long run it turns out that you were, you know, pushing in the wrong direction, and later you realize I should do this, that the axe to grind, I think, is really useful. Anyway, so that's one kind of answer. Maybe
you were looking for my disagreement. You know, they're different fields, different areas, but I know, like, I would strive for clarity. And, you know, there are caveats, which is not to say that I don't want to make a point, but I think sometimes you see people who are led by the idea, and they will. You know, in the paper, there's sort of the ideas, the equations, and the words in between the equations, and they don't always match up. And I actually find it annoying when, you know, somebody has that axe to grind and sort of only presents the work in a way where, you know, I needed this answer, and so I'm interpreting this in that particular way. And they're not asking, I don't know, they're not asking the bigger questions, or trying to do other things to really test their ideas. And I guess I'm being annoyed because there's a certain set of authors that have been doing that. But I guess I'm just back, you know, repeating myself. I strive for clarity. But I am a big believer in sort of what I said, is where, you know, you've done all this work, but then to step back and try and understand. When I said a story, what I meant is just, how do you tell that story? What's the arc that cleanly takes you from the beginning to the point you want to be?
I mean, I think it's always important to be clear in whatever story you're telling, what the sort of caveats, what the assumptions you're making are, how it could be disproven, right? Like you want to at least, you know, you're always going to have some bias one way or another because that's how humans work, but you want to be approaching these questions from the point of curiosity. You just really want to understand, right? And so, you know, you can put forward an argument saying, I think that this is the interpretation of this, but there should always be a section saying, you know, that here are the assumptions I made, and you might make different assumptions, and there's, you know, these authors over here said something else, and here's why I don't think that's true. But, you know, you can say, you know, there's a lot of times when you're writing, you'll be putting in, you know, here's, you know, you'll say such and so thing, and you'll put some references, then you'll put a semicolon, you'll say, but see also, and then there's some reference that totally disagrees with that, right? And that's something that you have to kind of get used to doing, that like there's always going to be kind of different ways of interpreting, and the assumptions are always going to be, you're always going to make some assumptions somewhere, and that might or might not be justified. So just, I think being clear about the limitations of the work is one way it makes it useful, right? Because then you know people know what they can tweak to build on that work. They know where something might have gone wrong. They know kind of where to look to extend it. You know, like it's and they can put it in the proper context. So I think like you can make an argument and you can say, you know, here's why I think this is true. And here's the place where, if you want to disagree with me, that's how you start doing that, right? And I think that's a good way to kind of not get too caught up in your own kind of perspective.
That goes back again to that really fundamental principle of utility. How is this useful to others? And so foreseeing some of the objections, counter arguments, or other ways, that is super useful. You're doing part of the work of critiquing, in a sense, for the reader. Or with the reader,
and it also helps a lot with the referee report, because if you don't do that, the referees are gonna they need to find something to talk about in the referee report,
yeah.
And so they'll say, oh, but you didn't look at this thing, or oh, you didn't mention this other paper, or this other thing disagrees, I don't believe you on that. You know? But if you do all that work ahead of time, it makes it a lot easier to go through that peer review process.
I'm gonna ask there's one last question. We're gonna have to wrap up, we're a little bit over time. So let's just do one more question.
Actually, I have a question about writing my research. Really, I just find some creations and comments, the results, conservation results, but after the talk, it seems like I have to include some stories, maybe I have to explain some details about the conversations. Can you give us some advice about?
So when you say research notes, do you mean like, do you mean not a paper for publication, but
for
like internal to your collaboration or that kind of thing? Yeah, I mean, I think it depends on the group that you're presenting it to. Right? Like you just always it depends on what context they already have and how much they need to be kind of led through the topic. So I don't know that there's any particular standard for
I'm just thinking of, you know, notes in a commenting program or a mathematics cookbook. You know, what do you need to know so that when you come back to this a year from now, you'll be able to understand what you're doing? But yeah, it's a very personal thing. Depends on you, your collaborator.
Don't underestimate how quickly you forget. This is another one of these sort of strange things about having decades of things, so you can just look at them and be like, oh, that's in there? What was it like? So, you know, somehow, like, be kind to future you.
It can be really useful to have a habit of writing research notes on the afternoon. You figure something out, you go write up a little thing late there. You know, I'll find stuff on my laptop that, you know, I wrote 10 years ago that's kind of like, well, I forgot about that. That is kind of insightful. And now maybe I see something I can do with that. So it's sort of good to have like a body of notes and, you know, just explain to your future self. In a way, like, if you're writing to your collaborators on a research project, you know, there's a lot of shorthand you can use, like, oh, you know what I mean. That could be a good springboard for kind of first draft. Like, oh, there's a lot that has to be expanded on here because we can speak in conversation really quickly about the basic idea, but to really turn that into something that you could understand a year from now or that anyone else can understand requires work. But, you know, sometimes that's what you want to do. You just want to send a message to your collaborator and say, this is the basic idea I had last night, and that's enough. So it kind of depends on context.
So guys, I think we're going to have to wrap it up here, but this has been, like, they've given you a ton of, I think, very useful information. And your supervisors, and even amongst each other, you already have what it takes to be writers and editors, and so go forth. Please thank the panel.